The Disciplined Investor is all about you, your money, and the markets. Sit back and get ready for this edition of the Disciplined Investor Podcast.
This episode of The Disciplined Investor is sponsored by Horowitz & Company. If you're looking for a portfolio manager, look no further. Horowitz & Company, from seed through harvest, cultivating financial success.
The employment numbers disappoint. Stocks start the quarter with a gain. Oil down for the week. And our guest today, Howard Silverblatt, Senior Index Analyst with Standard & Poor's Dow Jones Indices. All this and much more on episode number 529 of the Disciplined Investor Podcast. Well, hello and welcome. This is Andrew Horowitz, the host of the Disciplined Investor Podcast. And we have a good amount of things to talk about today. I spent the weekend this past few days working on a homemade plum brandy because during the holiday of Passover, we always have, at least in my family, something called Shlivovitz. I've talked about this before on DH Unplugged. It's this plum brandy. It's kind of like a grappa. Very strong, very harsh. But over the years, I've looked for a good Shlivovitz, something with taste more than just the fire that's going down your throat. And I decided this year, you know what? I'm going to try my hand at making it. I have no idea how it's going to come out. Not the most difficult recipe in the world, but it just takes a lot of time to go through the process. For the first 2 weeks, got to rotate the bottles that I made with all the different fruits and grain alcohol and sugars and all that every day. And then I got to stick it in a closet or somewhere dark and dry and cool for about 3 to 4 months. And then open it up, and hopefully it's not going to be some disgusting, horrid concoction, but rather something that is tasty and delicious to have as the opening salvo to the holiday. We'll see. Not the most difficult thing to make, but it could be fun. I remember back a number of years ago that I think it was my grandparents' 50th wedding anniversary, that they pulled out a bottle of brandy that they had in the basement they forgot about for like 50 years. They did it on their wedding. They made this bottle of brandy and we opened it up. It was delicious. It was absolutely delicious. So I'm hopefully going to be having some of that kind of fun coming up these holidays in, I guess it's in February or March, maybe April. For Passover coming up next year, whatever that time is. Just before we get into a few of the things that I want to discuss today, I'll just mention again that we did have two things. We had that launch party last week for Investology. If you're interested in a technology-enhanced, advisor-crafted portfolio management, and if you don't know what that is, just go over to investology.com. There's links all over the disciplinedinvestor.com website. You check it out. It's a minimum of $10,000 to invest. And what we're doing here is trying to match and bring out the best of what I would call, and I dare say, traditional robo-advising, but not really. A little bit of a twist on that with what we actually do here. So if you've ever wanted to invest with us with our traditional global asset allocation models where we usually have a $500,000 minimum, we've taken that down. Now, it's a little bit different, but you'll get the taste of it when you actually go over and check it out. And what's really nice about it, as I've mentioned before, and if you weren't with us for the launch party webinar, you can watch the replay. But what's really nice about it is you can actually in real time design your portfolio, depending on your risk and your time horizon and a variety of other factors, to see what's happening. And it actually will update in real time your portfolio allocation so you can make a decision on what is the best fit for you. And then we handle all of the investing. And these are portfolios that we've developed. And it's an algorithm that we've developed, a way of looking at your risk, your time horizon, who you are, what your thoughts are in terms of investing, what your desires are for your long term and your needs for the longer term or shorter term, depending on what we're looking to do. And that's how we create these portfolios. Pretty cool process. So you should go check that out over at investology.com. And we also, for you that have more of a desire to trade a little bit faster, we had a webinar with Trigger Charts this week. Some of the programming that we've done for TradeStation. We taught about the Commander Series and market profile and supply and demand and where the kickoffs for a move to the upside will be taken, where they are for the move to the downside, consolidation versus trending, a lot of really cool things. So you could probably go over to triggercharts.com and sign up for the next two that are coming up in the sequence. We'll have the replays also available on a variety of different areas so you can see it. But let's talk a little bit about what's going on in the markets now and what's happening, because it was kind of a, I thought of it, a very interesting week. We have a lot of strength in a lot of areas, not only here in the US, but around the world. I think we could all agree to that. Now, of course, if you don't agree with that and you're thinking, well, maybe some of these numbers are massaged, maybe they're BS, maybe just a government plot to make us think one thing when it's really not, because you're seeing something in your area. Let's not do that. Let's just take the numbers as what they are, because it's the best piece of information that we have available. And even if we, you, myself, anybody, John or Joe or Pam, don't agree with it, it doesn't matter. It's the markets that matter. How the market participants are dealing with the information, how they are assimilating what they have, calculating what they think it means, and then acting upon it in the markets. So it's a very simple process. If there is a time that the markets don't believe the information, think that the trend is changing, or look at it as there's a question as to really the validity of this, they're going to change direction. So we're going to keep in mind that when we look at economics, we also look at it in the perspective of what the market participants are, how they're dealing with this, how they're absorbing it, how they're understanding it, and how they're acting on it. But we did see that I think a really big shock was that there was a significant, not just a small, but a very significant miss on the employment numbers that we saw on Friday. The first Friday of the month, we come out with the employment numbers from the Labor Department. And this is for the first time in 7 years, actually, that there was no growth. Actually, there was losses in the jobs market for the period. So the Department of Labor's September number came out, and it showed that, because probably a lot to do with the various hurricanes, that 33,000 people weren't working. In other words, instead of jobs growth, we had a subtraction from the market, 33,000 people. There was expectations of about, I think it was close to a plus 50,000 versus this negative 33,000. That's a big differential. But a couple of things in that same report that we saw countered the idea that this is a terminal problem, that it really is just a transitory issue. And let me take you on a few of those. First of all, about 105,000 jobs were lost in the lower paying bar and restaurant jobs. We know that many of these places were closed down in Florida, Texas, obviously, around other areas throughout Louisiana. There was a lot of areas that were affected by this, and the impact on it was that some of the companies that have shorter term labor conditions and more temporary type of labor that could come and go and be put on very quickly or taken off very quickly, dropped a lot of jobs. However, what was really interesting was that the average hourly wages rose about 0.5%, that now took it up to an annualized about 3% rate. In addition to that, what was kind of really odd is that the headline jobs number fell to 4.2%. In other words, the unemployment number fell to 4.2% while the economy was losing jobs. A little strange. A little off, but it's probably because that when we look at the entire pool of people out there that are working and not working, and there was some statistical anomaly that went on in there, but I guess it's because a lot less people were looking for work and a lot of people out of the labor force at that point. So if you pull a few hundred thousand people out of the labor force, probably what you're going to get is this kind of reaction. Now there was a wonky move on the dollar and on gold, and the thought that, wow, we're at a 4.2% rate. Okay, well, the dollar shot up, gold shot down, then it came back up and turned around entirely, and gold was up by the end of the day. The dollar was down. A little weird. I think actually the entire action on Friday was a little weird. The markets were down for a while after the print came out. Then by the end of the day, they finished up next to about even. So we still see that there's a bullish tendency. There's a buy the dip, buy anything. Just for God's sakes, buy something attitude that's going on in markets right now. And I think this is also on the heels of what we did see, that even though there was a lot less jobs that were in the markets, and a lot of people left and a lot of people were fired, and a lot of people not working for the month, and a lot of it had again to do with these hurricanes and the weather, we did see that both ISM manufacturing and ISM services did really well. So we saw that the Purchasing Managers Index, the ISM, rose to 60.8, the best level since 2004. The service sector also had a really nice move. It moved up 4.5 points to 59.8%. Its highest level since 2005. And the expectation was that the services index was actually going to tick it down. Now, what's, again, a little odd is that if we lost all these people during the period in September in the services area, jobs are lost, as the major jobs are lost in the bars and restaurants and a few other areas in the services area, how did we see such a major impact on the upside for the ISM services index? A little strange. We did also see that oil did tick down, which was also another strange situation because we saw that a hurricane coming into the Gulf again. Why is oil ticking down? A lot of things don't make sense. Maybe it was the dollar that was up for a while, but then it came back down. I mean, this is just I'll be very honest with you. There's a lot of very strange movements in the markets compared to what the data is telling us. It seems a very almost opposite reaction. You know, when things are bad, when we see a terrible terrorist act, markets go up. When we see a really good number, markets come in. When we see that confirmation of the services index really doing well, but yet a lot of losses in the services side. It's very strange. But we did see oil down about 4.5% lower for the week. And we also saw that during the week, there was a gain for the week on stocks. Now, coming up next week, we have Monday is Columbus Day. So a lot of government offices are closed, but the markets are open for trading. No major news is scheduled. No major releases of economic information. We're going to go into Wednesday until we really start seeing a lot of things. On Wednesday, we're going to see minutes from last month's Federal Reserve policy meeting. Plus, we're going to see results from companies like Fastenal. Thursday's when it all starts kicking off in terms of earnings season. We're going to get to a lot of this discussion with our guest today. But we have JP Morgan coming out with their earnings. We have Citigroup coming out with their earnings. We have the producer price index for wholesale inflation also coming out on Thursday. On Friday, we're going to see the CPI number. We're going to see the initial number for October for the UMISH consumer sentiment. September retail sales, earnings from Bank of America, PNC Financial, Wells Fargo. And there's going to be a speech, woohoo, from Janet Yellen. Another speech on monetary policy at the G30 conference in D.C. on Sunday morning. So into the weekend, we're going to be seeing some of that more action going on there. So that's kind of like a wrap of what's going on coming up into the next six days. I think that it's going to be kind of interesting to watch what happens. With a lot of the rhetoric over the tax, we're starting to see tax reform. We're starting to see a little bit of already some question as to if we're going to be able to get all this through. But we're going to have that coming up, and that's going to be in the monitor and discussion, some politics on a global basis, what's happening. And, of course, we're going to see the central bankers coming out, talking back and forth. One of the big things that we're going to see over the next supposedly couple of weeks is the appointment, or at least the finalization of an appointment recommendation for the Federal Reserve. And it may be Janet Yellen, it may not be. Maybe Gary Cohn, it may not be. It may be Walsh, it may be Cash Carey. There's a lot of names that are in the hat right now as possible players that may get the nod as to the next one. I would think that it's going to have to be one that is very much pro deregulation, as well as somewhat of a soft monetary policy. We'll see. We'll see how that goes. Anyway, let's kind of segue in and get right to our guest, why don't we? And our guest today is Howard Silverblatt, He's been on before. He's with S&P Dow Jones Indices. He's a senior index analyst. As I say, he's the keeper of all the earnings data for the S&P index and the stocks and the companies and all that. Howard, it's been a while. How are you?
I've been good. Maybe not as good as the market's been lately, but I've been good.
Nobody can be that good. It's impossible. Just absolute, you know, cheer and just fanfare and loveliness. But we're going to talk a little bit about this because I've been talking to you earlier about how, you know, and I've seen this also, there's this whole notion that nobody wants to sell because what's happening is, and there's a lot of excuses, well, because, you know, we got the passive investors that are just plowing money in. And of course, we have the tax situation that may reduce taxes. And if they do so, well, why not hold on till next year, which is kind of what we saw at the end of 2016 as well. And I know you've been hearing some of the same kind of banter, right?
Yeah, it doesn't seem to be a willingness to get out or even buy a lot of insurance on the downside yet at this point in time. The market went from focusing on fundamentals, you know, for the past 3-4 months when it was ignoring some of the Washington events and slowly moved up, setting new highs. Then we got the potential for income tax reform came in, which helped a lot. Some repatriation talk on there, and the street is now definitely focused on Washington, what they do. And of course, earnings season is coming up. I mean, Q2 was a major test for the market. The earnings mostly came through, did very well. We set a couple of records on there. Buybacks were a little bit lower, so we didn't get the tailwind. So companies actually made their money last quarter the old-fashioned way, if you remember those commercials. They earned it. It wasn't with the share count reduction, but Q3 is what everyone is hoping for right now, shorter term. Washington still has to deal with the budget and debt, and then, of course, income tax. But Q3 is going to be here starting next week, and the week after, it's going to start to bulk up. And that's what the trades are going to be dominated by, the actual Q3 and, of course, the guidance. And that's going to be the major test, whether the market can hold on to these highs or take a breather and slightly move back.
So let's kind of go – let me take a couple of parts of that, because over the last several quarters – actually, let's go back even further. Let's go back a year and a half or so, when every conference call was dominated in the guidance and discussion part about what we'd call, and I have a real thing about this, constant currency basis accounting, right? You know, this is the new thing. This was not the excuse of, oh, the weather, which we have, by the way, coming up. The next excuse will, of course, be the weather. But we had this constant currency as the dollar before, about a year and a half ago, was kind of moving higher. There were some headwinds due to the high value of the dollar. And many of the companies that are multinationals, exporting in particular, had this whole discussion that kind of was all over. Now, all of a sudden, you don't see it. Not only that, we know that the dollar is down about 10% from its high. Where is that in the equation? Are we seeing a lot of benefit for companies due to the dollar being smacked the last 6-8 months?
Depends which point you're taking. And there's a lot of talk about this from currency markets and currency traders, but not so much more the market. As you said, it was hot last year when it was needed. If you look at the traded weight on it, the dollar looks like it may hopefully have hit the bottom September, about September 6th or 7th around there, and then it's moved up from there. So we've got a gain. As the dollar moves up on that traded weight scale, it hurts the S&P 500 earnings, okay? But as you said, it's been volatile. Year to date, the traded weight is still flat. You want to go back 3 years, the traded dollar is up 11%, which overall for that time period means it's hurt the index. So again, we went down September, kind of boomeranged up for the last month or so. We have to see if it holds, but it didn't have that much as much impact on the Q3 earnings, you know, traditional September time period, because it hit the bottom September and then went up for the other rest of the month on there. So we would expect to hear some things about it, especially from discretionary issues, because those things move very quickly. I can decide not to go out tonight or not buy something very quickly, as compared to if I'm ordering a piece of equipment from Caterpillar, say, which is going to take months to make and then deliver. I'm going to be a bit more long-term, and so the short-term rates will not impact me as much. Right. But definitely we anticipate some verbiage with more discretionary than the industrials.
So now we saw some record earnings. You know, we were in this, I'll call it this consolidation, you know, kind of earnings were moving up and it was better. And we saw a lot of earnings, at least from what I saw, you can correct me, but I saw a lot of earnings benefit from the share repurchases over the last, I don't know, 8 years or something like that. And then what we saw was actually those share repurchases kind of settled down a little bit. And the earnings number in the last quarter, as you mentioned, it hit some record numbers in terms of, you know, earnings per share, total earnings. And finally, we saw revenue start to pick up, right? It was a laggard for a long time.
Yeah. The revenue is a major one. It looks like it's going to be a major one again this quarter. But going to your first point on the buybacks, buybacks are really helping to fuel the issues. Basically, over 20% of the S&P 500 for about 2.5 years was increasing their EPS by at least 4% year over year by reducing their share count. So if I made $1 last year and $1 million this year, if I reduce my shares, instead of saying I made a dollar EPS, it's now $1.04. There was a lot of tailwind in the index. That started to tail off last year. And to give you a couple of numbers on there, it was 26% for the second quarter of last year. And this year, that went down to 14. So the companies, not just the buybacks went down, but the impact on the EPS. And while the initial takedown, you know, from the newspapers and from the talks was that, gee, that's bad. Companies are pulling back, even though they have tons of money, actually a record amount in the second quarter to do buybacks. It turned out to be good. It was a vote of confidence. They could have increased the amount and taken more shares down. They chose not to. And Q2 ended up to be a good quarter, good earnings. When you take them down, cash flow is good and a record. And they did it without the buybacks.
Right.
So, yes, the buybacks help and they're nice and they, you know, more buying always pushes up a stock. But if you could make it the old fashioned way again, that's good. You know, cash flow and earnings. So that's important. Q3, we'll have to see how much impact we have on there. We're expecting more from the banks, but maybe less than the rest. Again, remember, the banks got all got approval to buy more. And a lot of their options are going to have to cover on there. The stock prices have moved up. So at this point in time, buybacks for the third quarter may not move up as much, so we may not get that tailwind outside of the financials. But that's where those go. But as far as the sales, yes, sales were the lagging items. They moved up last quarter. This quarter, the current estimate, again, we haven't really started. The banks will start that later next week, about 4.4% year over year. Well, that may not be nice compared to the 14 to 15% earnings expectation, but sales haven't moved.
Yeah.
A 4% number is nice at this point in time.
So
that's a very good number and helps the margin. Second quarter margin was a record. We're expecting third quarter may beat that out.
Now, how are they getting to those record margins? I mean, I think margins are one of the, I mean, if you break it all down, and you try your best to figure out what the difference between gross and net is in terms of margins. But margin expansion is one of the most important parts in terms of if a company can continually, obviously there's a level that you can't go beyond, but if companies continue to either keep their margins really tight and increase their margins over time, I see that as a real positive.
Yeah, it definitely margin expansion is important. They've got to break down how they're doing it. Cost cuts, reductions and either an employee changing in materials or products that, you know, from the bottom as compared to increasing the gross sales, which of course can come through internal methods or M&A, those two. At this point, over the last 2 years, it's been more growth because of cost reductions. So cutting to make the numbers, okay? But again, we did see the top number increase last quarter. There are decent estimates this quarter that will increase over that number, potentially setting a new record. Pretty close to it. The estimates now are like 1% over the record sales numbers. So if we can come anywhere near there, but again, a 4.4% year over year could help. It's not necessarily across the board. You know, energy is the big one, about 26% estimated year over year, but
From a very low base. Yeah. So
right.
Let me ask you this. So what do you have? Because I think you have this number somewhere buried in. You have these spreadsheets that are awesome, but you probably know exactly. You've been doing this for how long have you been doing this?
God help us. I'm in my 41st year.
Oh, my God. Low turnover over at S&P Dow Jones Industries, I'll tell you that. Now, let me ask you this. So what is the effective average tax rate on S&P companies?
25.6%.
Right.
Okay. And that's the actual effective on what you're paying. And understand about 42 companies actually got, out of the 500 got money back. Okay. And it varies a lot depending upon who you are. Example, telecom is over a third.
Hmm.
Okay. There's just a lot on there. Real estate, which passes through a lot for the dividends on there, therefore doesn't pay a lot of taxes, and it's 3%. So how income tax goes, you know, on the Hill now, again, we need budgets to be done first in order to keep the 51 votes in there, is going to make a big difference. And that's why Wall Street is paying attention, because a dollar on taxes is worth a lot more than a dollar in sales. That's the bottom line.
Yeah. Cut it right out.
Change me a dollar, I keep it. That could increase the margins even farther than they are now. And again, we are at a record level right now, margins. At this point in time, it was 10.14 for the second quarter. That's what we know. So that is a record. The third quarter, the estimate is 10.85. We keep it. We don't. It's early in the season.
Mm-hmm.
But it's pointing at least in the right direction higher. And income tax would only make that much higher.
So, but if we go to a 25% tax rate from the top rate, is that going to necessarily change the net effective tax if there's a bunch of deductions that will be removed? And I mean, companies are pretty good at this as it is, figuring out ways to really work the whole system. Are they going to? So if we go from a 35% to a 25%, does that mean the effective tax rate will go down to, let's say, 20% or, 18%?
Well, again, the 9 pages that were released and even the verbiage didn't add that too much to that. We have to see how it comes out. It's the bells and whistles. How do you get there? If we did it down to the 20% you're saying, as an example, we'd get about a 6.25% increase in S&P 500 earnings for a year, that time period on there. We'd get more, if they do repatriation, but we don't have any of the numbers there. And, of course, if we reduce individual income tax brackets, the feeling is that consumer discretionary, is going to eventually benefit more. If you and I have more money in our pockets, we're going to buy more, whether it be directly or through new toys, electronics.
Yeah, I don't know if you saw the discussion about, this tax code, this new tax deduction for an average family of four is going to, save you $1,000 per year. So that new kitchen that you wanted to put in, hey, you got the money to do it now. And I'm thinking, wait a minute, what kind of a new kitchen am I putting in with $1,000?
And the tax proposals, again, the SALT is major. That's the state and local tax deductions. You're down in Florida.
Yeah.
Okay. You don't have income tax.
Right.
You don't want to know what it is up here in New York.
Yeah. And the city and the state and all that. It's terrible.
Right. So again, the bells and whistles are going to make a difference. But again, if you went down to 20, it's a little over 6% that you're going to gain. Okay. So it is a positive item on there. But again, the bells and whistles are going to make a big determination on here.
Now you talked about
they take away.
You talked about repatriation. Now there's a lot of discussion about repatriation in terms of if there is this massive repatriation, maybe a one-time 10%, surcharge penalty tax that to bring money back. What's going to be done with that? Some say, it's going to get itself, into the economy, et cetera. Some say, it's going to really ramp up into automation and companies maybe will do share buybacks with it and all that. But there's not going to be a lot of this just kind of like, it's not like manna from heaven. So how is the repatriation going to help out the earnings?
Well, they'll help that the companies have more money in there. It'll be cleansed. They can do what they want. They don't have to borrow, even though borrowing is very cheap, especially if you go abroad, to Europe or Germany or something. You can practically walk away with the money from there. But the hopeful amount for the market is that the money coming back will somehow work its way down and companies will reinvest in it. That was the hope in 2004, and obviously it didn't work too well. So how they structure it is going to be important. Congress can't do, at least the courts so far, said you can't make them buy made in the USA. And if you look at when we came up with the accelerated depreciation schedule that's on there, foreign companies went up more than the U.S. you know, those affected by the machinery because they will buy abroad. But the hope is that bringing it back somewhere between 8.5 to 10%, depending upon whether it's considered new or old money, will help stimulate. On the street, we look at it that it's going to probably help M&A a lot. Right. Everyone has a list on there, and by adding available money may trigger it there. After M&A, buybacks. Okay. Third on the line, unfortunately.
So those two things, by the way, M&A,
dividends.
M&A and buybacks.
M&A and buybacks.
And buybacks have not helped the economy.
M&A recently has not been as hype. We haven't even seen bottom fishing yet. The buybacks help support the market short term.
Yeah, of course.
If I've got five people bidding on my house, it's worth more than if three people were bidding on it.
Right.
But you're right. Long term, the last person holding a share owns the company.
Yeah.
This is a reverse merger. So those haven't helped as much. The M&A, if you can get, God help us, you know, the true savings. I don't want to hear the word synergy again. We're probably sick of it, but
right.
That could come back in. And the third item on there is dividends. Dividends probably would help, would come into shareholders, you know, as some money, but dividends move a lot slower. Companies can turn on and off their buybacks. They can do whatever they want to M&A. If you increase my dividend today,
yeah,
I expect the next quarter to be there. And next year, I expect more. So dividends are typically the last to hit the trail. It definitely would help repatriation. We almost got it about 2 years ago, repatriation, with the highway bill when that got stalled. But we've got to see what Congress does. You know, we're talking about the market. That's hard to predict. But Washington, that's another ball game.
Yeah. So let's kind of, first of all, what is the expected growth rate for EPS this quarter compared to a year ago?
Okay. 14.8% currently is where we're standing. And there's a big variance in why I know. As you mentioned, we had energy,
yeah,
okay, which is supposed to go up 311%.
Hmm.
But it's still going to be 70% lower than it was in June of 2014,
mm-hmm,
when oil was $105. But the 14.8 is very good. It's down from 18% last quarter. But again, we had some negative numbers, you know, for four or five quarters, you know, right up to the second quarter of last year. Q2 last year was actually down 1.7%. Yes, energy did some of the damage on there, but technology was also there, and telecom did not do that well. So it's a nice gain. It would put us in a nice record on there. You know, the 14.8 is good. Technology is going to probably be the major issue. Technology is supposed to go up 33%. It contributes about 24% of the earnings. And third quarter is, by the way, not even its strong quarter. Fourth quarter is. So 33% is a nice number. The financials obviously will be the first one out, and that's going to be a test on there to see what they did and what they didn't do, because the estimates are not that great. I mean, rates, shock and dismay, while they're up in the last couple of weeks, they're still lower than they were year end.
Right.
And some of the trading picked up, but still not those record trading, and M&A, investment income is not going to be stellar yet.
So what's the PE you have backwards and forward now?
Okay, for the current time period, what we're looking at is about a 21 based on the 12 months now, about 20 for year end. Going forward to next year, if someone wants to believe it, 17.6. Those are still historically high.
Yep.
Okay, not as bad as they were last quarter, but what's happening is while the earnings are going up, the market's been going up.
Mm-hmm.
So the PEs have cut down a little. If the market was flat, obviously PEs would be better. But I think we'd rather have a higher price. So, yeah, there's still a lot of discussion on are we spending too much for expected earnings at this point in time. And, again, that increases the importance of Q3. We don't just need the rhetoric and the discussions at how good it's going to be and how great it is. Need to see the numbers. You actually booked this in Q3. Your sales were so much. Your cash flow was so much. Okay? If guidance, that's important. But similar to Q2, we need to see the numbers now. So it's put up or decline.
So let me ask you, let's get down to some of the nitty gritty, something that, you know, people may not know about, the whole idea of, how do we put this, massaging the numbers. What I mean by that is companies know, listen, I know several publicly traded companies that during their conference calls, they have their stock up on a big screen. They have the calls up on another one with, you know, the Q&A that's coming in. They watch tick by tick with every word that is spoken out of either the CEO's or CFO's or CIO's mouth, what's happening with the stock. And I'll tell you, I also know that they adjust those numbers and the discussion and the kind of how they're phrasing things and how they're putting things out there depending on what the reaction is. So you have numbers that come out and whatever the numbers are, and let's say they meet or beat. We also know that companies have been, tell me when I'm wrong here, companies have been really good at saying, you know, we believe we're going to earn 32 cents and here's our revenues and here's our growth rates and all that. And here's all the numbers to put in all of your calculations. And they beat it by 1 or 2 cents because they know what they fed the analysts already, right?
You are totally correct. Okay. Two-thirds of the companies almost beat their estimates. Shock and dismay. Earnings should be a required MBA class, or two, maybe even three. Managing your manager, well, in this case, it's managing the shareholders and the press and the analysts. Basically, what we've seen over the last 3 to 4 years as fair disclosure has changed and guidance has changed, but course of requirements, is that if a company is going to miss their estimate, they try to get ahead of it. Mm-hmm. On there. The street thinks it's a dollar. I move down my estimate and say it's going to be 90 to 95 cents or so. Where, if it's going to beat the number, what they're doing more recently over the last year and a half is just sitting back. They'll ride the gain, mm-hmm. but they want to get ahead of the pain.
Right.
And this has been noticed because if you look at short-term traders who are doing options, when the numbers are coming out, they get that first tick, I beat, I didn't beat, mm-hmm. Before the conference is even over, they follow that a lot more strictly and they've noticed and traded on those kind of items. But companies do try to get ahead of the bad news, but they want the good news to go up there. And for the current quarter, we have not seen that many negatives.
Right.
Second quarter, we didn't see a lot. We did, and it ended up it wasn't a lot. So the lack of major negative news, but by the numbers of the companies, not just, how much one company may be taking it down for a reason, but, let's say out of the 500 or out of the 1500 or the Russell, whichever you're using, out of those, how many have come down, has not been that large this quarter. Which adds to the belief that it's going to be a good quarter.
Now, that reminds me. I know you have the S&P 600. By the way, there's just so everybody know, there's the S&P 500 is the one that everybody follows. But there's a lot of other indices the S&P Dow Jones Index Services has. For example, just like you've seen, small, large, mid-cap, there's an S&P 1500. Out of that, you can take out the S&P 400, which is the mid-cap, the S&P 600, which is a small-cap index. What are your levels right now? I remember back in the days that under 500 million in market cap was a small cap, right?
Yeah.
Over a billion was a large cap. We didn't even have mid-caps. Forget that. Mid-caps weren't, it was like, all right, whatever. What's the demarcation point now for small caps?
Well, we look for small caps to be under that $1.5 billion. They've got to make, and again, across different indices, not just S&P, but other ones, they've got numbers somewhere around there, a little higher, a little lower. So if someone's looking at a small cap, that's what they're looking at. They're also looking within the S&P that has to be certain liquidity ratios on it. It has to be able to trade, and be institutionally held. And that's for all the indices on there. One of the problems with the small caps, though, very often with portfolio managers, let's say that small cap moves up. It's done well. It's good. Typically, theoretically, we move it into the S&P, might move it into a mid-cap issue. Portfolio manager who's doing the small cap, if they want to stick with that issue, they're going to keep that issue in their small cap fund because that's their domain,
mm-hmm.
which may become overpowering as it grows. It's like having an apple in with a mid-cap issue. It's all apple.
Right.
So, but the small caps did very well last month. They've been a lot. They're a lot more volatile. The volatility on that is nothing like the S&P 500 or the mid cap. You know, it's a lot more risk on there. If you know which issue to buy, you should buy it. But if you need to get a little bit less risk and you're giving up reward, of course, you know, an index on a small cap obviously has higher potential, but you got a higher potential for loss.
Yeah. And a large cap, what's the demarcation point now for that?
$4 billion on there, a lot more. So it's four and a half. Now, a company could decline and be less than that, and it's not taken out, okay? But to get in, we're looking for that. Again, higher liquidity values. They have to be able to trade. On average, 70% of an S&P 500 company is owned by institutions.
Right.
So they have to be able to get in and out, and they're all going to probably do it at the same time.
Right.
So it could be a problem. Also, the one other item when you get into the S&P 500, traders may not realize, is about 15% of the S&P 500 is actually licensed. In other words, Vanguard's, Fidelity's. They go in. Whatever changes S&P makes in there, they buy and sell. So 15% of it automatically is in there. So what goes in and what goes out brings a lot of trading.
Right.
Okay. It's less on a mid cap and a small cap, but on the larger size, if it gets put into an index, it's a major buying item. And there's smaller boutique houses that specialize in helping funds to match the numbers.
Right. It's pretty amazing, actually, over the years that this may be something you can or can't talk about, but how the rise of the index, which was meant to be, you know, a tracking mechanism to see what's going on, now it's like you can't beat the index. So we could either say that the S&P 500, you guys are the best managers in the whole wide world because everybody's just given up, right? I mean, all these active managers are giving up.
Yeah.
I'm just saying.
It's hard to beat an index, especially on the top when it's going up. When the index makes a change, it costs nothing. Issue comes in, issue comes out. If you're a fund manager, you've got to do trading. You've got regulatory. You've got holders. You've got distribution. So just matching the index, if the index was up 10, you're going to have to do well over 11 just to get there. Okay, so there's some kind of difficulty with that. Most fund managers do not beat the index.
Mm-hmm.
But the ones that do, you know, they go against the grain. There's also something called emulators. It's kind of the street name for it. Some fund that will try to buy about 70% of the index, because
mm-hmm.
that's what they're going to be measured against,
mm-hmm.
you know. And with the 30%, they'll come out with a smaller list of buys or sells, whatever they want to do. So they're overweight here or there. So they may have 20 or 30 stocks that they're playing, and the other 70% of their money they're doing into the S&P 500, either straight issues, they could be using instruments, you know, buyback, however they're dealing with. And emulators, the feeling is a lot more than 15% of the market, because at the end of the day, depending upon the risk factor, you want to beat your benchmark, which in many cases is the S&P 500, and you have fees. So somehow you have to beat mm-hmm. the index in order to match their number, because you've right. got all these other costs.
Right. Has there been any, I don't know if you could talk about this either, but maybe, has there been any internal discussion about the concern of the rise of passive investing, all the ETFs that are indexing rather than, some of these very new types of investment processes and where, you know, again, it's passive or it's index investing and how everybody's kind of succumbed to is to saying, you know what, we're just going to put our money in the S&P. Why bother with anything else here? Has there been any internal discussion about this?
There's been a lot of external, and obviously S&P, and I'll be limited to what I say, you know, has had discussions with this and analysis of this. As the index has grown, okay, that 15%, I say that, you know, that's held by licensed indexes, forget the emulators,
mm-hmm.
you know, was 11% 3 or 4 years ago. Okay, so it has grown, but so has the ETF market, so has a lot of instruments. You know, the joke is that there's more instruments than stocks.
Yeah.
You could do so many permutations.
Right.
But you do have to worry, and again, I'll get away from the passive versus active, where at some point does any kind of instrument control too much of a market,
mm-hmm.
you know, that it dominates it. We have a telecom sector right now. AT&T and Verizon are over 80% of that.
Right. Right.
Okay. That's a dominance in there. We used, you know, we have indices with and without Apple because Apple is so big. There used to be one with and without General Motors well before I got to S&P.
Yep.
So you have to worry about the liquidity and the ability. But it's at this point, you know, it's not an enormous amount compared to historical values, but it's definitely growing. And passive is, you know, a lot of people are doing that risk reward scenario.
Mm-hmm. I hear you. Well, it's always a pleasure. We're going to cut it right here. Howard Silverblatt will make sure we have all the information on how to check out all the great offerings from S&P Dow Jones Indices, now a much longer name here. Senior index analyst with them. Always great to have you on. Earnings season starts in what?
Next week, the banks are going to go. Yeah. That's correct. So, and then 2 weeks, it'll be all trades.
So back in the day, what was the start of earnings season?
It used to be the old Alcoa. No longer in it. The real trading situation, though, is going to start on Thursday with Citibank, J.P. Morgan. Friday, you have Bank of America and Wells Fargo. And again, the financial sector is the one that we're not expecting a lot of growth in. So right off the bat, you're going to be tested for those issues and see how they do. But, you know, that's next week it starts. And the following week, you have 65 companies. And after that, it'll go into the hundreds. So again, by the end of the month, we'll have 70% of the issues in there. And if we had this conversation, it'll be more about retro than going forward.
Exactly. All right. Thanks a lot for joining me. I appreciate it.
Thank you. Take care.
Bye-bye. Bye. There you have it. Everything you need to know about earnings season and what's going to be going on in the next several weeks. Again, as I mentioned earlier, starting with the financials, the major financials at the end of this week, and then we start getting technology and a lot of names. I think Howard mentioned 65 or so the following week, and then hundreds of more coming in 2 weeks from now. So keep an eye on that. I'd also keep an eye on some of these gold miners. I think that we saw a really interesting level of support that checked in. One of the things that I did notice last week was that when we did see some weakness in gold, for the most part, the miners really didn't move a lot. Now, let's just switch over to the crude oil market for a second here. One of the things I noticed about 6 months ago or so, and I think we talked about this a little bit, was the fact that some of the oil patch stocks, you know, anything related to crude, whether it's refining, whether it was drilling and searching, or maybe even some chemical companies, they really were doing okay as oil was coming in. And it seemed to be a separation of the two. And it was almost like the many of the energy companies were sensing that the bottom was in. Now, if you look to gold, it's a whole different animal. There's some question as to whether many of these cryptocurrencies and altcoins and bitcoins and Ethereum and Ripple and all of these are now going to be the new quote-unquote alternative. And whether there's a lot of selling that's going on in gold because people are getting into this new alternative, an alternative asset that is easier to trade. It's more, you know, it's all the things they talk about, which I don't buy all of it, but one of the things that I think that's interesting to note is that we are seeing that many of the gold companies and the miners, like look at GDX, which is the gold miners ETF, is held up really kind of okay. And it held its support really well through the whole move of gold. And yeah, it did sell off a bit. But again, the more recent action was, I thought, a little bit towards the bullish side, at least starting to see some level of bullishness. So we did take a position in the Disciplined Investor Managed Growth Strategy, which is a trading strategy that we use for clients. We took a starter position, if you will, in the gold miners, and it's already paying off nicely. And we're going to look to possibly add on to that. So just keep that in mind, just to put on your radar screen, to put on your watch list, to take a look at what's going on there. Because I just wonder, I don't know. Again, I'm speculating and I'm telling you this and I'm saying in a way, and I hope I'm very clear, that is a pure speculation now. I'm not really hardcore pounding the desk on this one, but it's interesting to note how we're seeing that the gold miners, how they held up, and compared that and contrast that to what happened with energy companies ahead of the actual move for for crude oil before, you know, after it bottomed out and started racing higher. Just thought it was kind of interesting. Take a look at that. Other than that, if you want to contact me, of course, just go over to thedisciplinedinvestor.com and click on the Ask Andrew button, and you'll be able to just ask anything you want. Many of the questions we answer on the show. I got a few of them sitting, you know, just looking here. Yeah, I got about 4, 5, 6, 7 that, I got about 5 of them, I guess, right here. That we're gonna get to on the show coming up very soon. And of course, do your best to listen to some of the past discussions. We had a great discussion with Damon Southward recently on the Bitcoin and cryptocurrencies and altcoins and how to trade them, what to do, and a nice education on that. We have some great guests coming up. But anyway, we're going to end it there. Have a great week. Have a profitable week. And I'll see you on Tuesday night with DH Unplugged, John C. Dvorak, myself, talking about the more interesting aspects of money and finance. I'll see you then. Thanks a lot. Bye-bye.
The information presented in this podcast is not intended to be used as the sole basis of any investment decisions, nor should it be construed as advice designed to meet the investment needs of any particular investor. Some discussion contains forward-looking statements which are based on current expectations and differences can be expected. None of the information presented should be construed as an offer to sell or buy any particular security. As always, use your best judgment when investing.